Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi, I'm Bede Hill, and this is The D Word, the show where we talk dementia. Welcome along for another hour of dementia chat and music. We're always on the lookout for people with a story to tell, and this week's guest definitely falls into that category. Tommy Dunn was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 58, and he'll be joining me right after this, when my guest is dementia campaigner Tommy Dunn, who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's when he was 58. So when did Tommy begin to notice things weren't quite right?
As you say, I used to work on the railways, then I became the train interface manager for the North West, then I became the rail compliance manager for Major Trouble. And I was in there, a meeting with the directors one day, and I got up to say something, and no words came out. And I couldn't understand why nothing came out of my mouth. So apparently I just got up and walked out the room, and somehow I got home. And when my wife came in from the Gulf, I was under the bedclothes, shaking like a leaf. So she said, what's happened? And I couldn't tell her. So she phoned work and she said, what have you done to Tommy? What's happened to Tommy? He said, we don't know. We were having a meeting. He stood up and just walked out. That's how I know about that part. But she got the doctor there, and the doctor came in and said, the doctor said, what's happened? Like, and I couldn't tell him. So my wife said, what happened at work? He says, it looks like he's just shut down, you know. So obviously they put you on antidepressants straight away because they think you've had a breakdown, you know. And after about 6 weeks, I was getting worse and worse. And he said, you need to go and see a psychologist. I went to see a psychologist, and I was seeing them for about 5 months on and off. And they said, you're not getting any better. You need to see a psychiatrist. So I went to see a psychiatrist, and I'd seen the psychiatrist for a few months. And then one day she called me, wife and me, and said, he's got bipolar. My wife said, he hasn't got bipolar. She said, he has. So they put it on lithium, and I was getting worse on the lithium. So they increased the dose, which turned me into a zombie. So I used to sleep for about 18 hours a day, get up and go to bed. You know, it was just like absolute. And my wife kept saying, he hasn't got bipolar. I want a second opinion. So after about 6 months, they decided to send me to see the top psychiatrist in Musty Hill Hospital. So I went to see him, and he said, we've got to wean you off the tablets first. The wean you, which was a laugh, like, you know, suddenly getting withdrawal systems like that. But I've never known what they talk about when they say withdrawal system, but Christ, you don't, you're really on it. So eventually I was able to go and have my brain scans and my SPECT scans and my psychological tests. And then it was on the 19th of December 2011, which I know that date very well because it's our wedding anniversary, and I know it's my 52nd anniversary next December. So it's a date that always sticks in your mind. And he came up and he said, I've some good news for you, and I've some bad news for you. He said, the good news is you haven't got bipolar. But I said, oh, thank God for that. My wife said, I knew he didn't. He said, well, the bad news is you've got young onset dementia, Alzheimer's. But I've never felt fear like it in my life. I thought, my life's over. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be put in a home now. I thought, my family will come and see me every week, though. And then I thought, then it'll go to every 2 weeks. And then it'll go to every month. And then it'll be Easter. my birthday and Christmas. And that fear just shut me up, and that was the biggest fear. And it's a fear that's always stuck through me since the day I was diagnosed, to be being put in a home. But I used to think to myself, how come I can still think? So I thought it was very strange. So I went to a post-diagnostic group after about 6 months, the first post-diagnostic group. And it's a 6 week course, once a week. And on the last day, in the last hour, one of the managers come in, Jill Pendleton, who's a manager there, and she says, it's the year of action on dementia next year. So this was 2012, so it's going to be 2013. And she said, we'd like someone to go on this group that we've set up to plan out what we're going to do for the year. So my wife said, Tommy will do it. And I looked at it because I couldn't talk, and I'd lost all my confidence. And if she'd have been on a galloping horse, that horse would have stopped dead, believe me, because I thought, what have you done? What have you done? She said, you'll be all right. So I went to the first meeting, and they're all sitting around this big table, about 30 or 40 people, and they start introducing themselves. I'm Professor So-and-so, I'm Dr. So-and-so, I'm the CEO of So-and-so. So the creeping death's coming around to me, so I said, Tommy, don't service user. And you can see a few people look over the glass, think, what the hell's a service user doing here? So then they started talking about what it's like for people with dementia, they can't do this. But I thought, that's not what it's like at all. So, but I hadn't thought it. I said it out loud. So they said, did you say something then? So I'm at the crossroads in my life now. They would say nothing, but they would say, what you said is wrong. So I said, what you said is wrong. So I said, I can do this, and we can think, and this is it. And it changed the whole perspective. So for every meet I went down, they asked my opinion. So that gave me a confidence. So then it comes the year of action on dementia. We're going to launch it at the Florence Institute. And they said, will you do a talk to the people there? And I've got the confidence back then. I said, yeah, I'll do that. And they said, oh, Prince Charles will be there. So anyway, after the event, you're going to get some photographs. And there's an old pub across the road. And these two fellas shouts across, hey, Charlie, come and have a pint. And he did. He went across the road, the other half at Guinness. So in the paper, it was all Prince Charles, man of the people, as drinking the local. And in the footnotes, it's the year of action on dementia. So we missed out on that bit.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
King Margot are the band, and that's called A Good Woman here on UK Health Radio, where you find a host of great shows concentrating on every aspect of health. You can listen to the live feed at www.ukhealthradio.com or choose to download or listen again. I'm chatting to dementia campaigner Tommy Dunn about his dementia journey, which comes with an added superpower.
Every person, when they're diagnosed, they have to hold their hands out. In one hand, they put the diagnosis of dementia, and in the other hand, they give it a superpower. So you'd always say, what's the superpower? They go, oh, you're fired out. So you're going around, and every now and again, you put your hand in your pocket, take out your diagnosis of dementia, look at it, and then you look at the superpower, and you think, what's this superpower? And I found out when I went up to the golf, my wife and I are members, both members of the golf club, and I went in, people didn't know I'd been diagnosed. So he said, hello, Tommy, I haven't seen you for ages. I said, where have you been? I said, well, I've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's dementia, And that's when I found out what the superpower was, because as soon as I said it, he stopped talking to me. I became invisible. They talked about me over around me, and all the people were asking my wife, how is he? How are you coping? You're going to have to put him in a home. It's as if you were invisible here. So that's the power that you get. You get the power to become invisible. Now, what happens now is because I'm talking about what it's like living with dementia and that, My wife's become the invisible one now because as the kids get pushed further and further in the background and they become invisible. People don't see them anymore. You know, they're just as if, well, they've got to be there. Like, you know, but it's not the case. They should be in front of us because they're the ones we lead. They're the ones I look for the support and make sure I'm there all the time. I mean, I couldn't function without my wife being my support, being my rock there behind me all the time.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's often the case that sadly carers get almost ignored, really. But I always take it as, and you seem to have had this, is the best way is a team approach. You know, you are a team, the pair of you.
It's the only way. It's the only way you can survive, you know, because you'll fall down. There's no way you can go forward in the venture on your own. You've got to have that care of support right beside you there. And that's why they need the support, because if they go down, people will come and say, we need two carers then, like, you know. So, but unfortunately, in this society, carers are treated like third-class citizens. You know, they're not even treated as second-class citizens, but third-class citizens. No, it breaks my heart to see the way they're actually treated.
Yeah,
for the money they get, nothing. I mean, that was one of the funniest things. My wife used to get about £64 a week carers allowance before she got a pension. And the day she got a pension, they stopped that because they assume she's not a carer anymore, you know. So it goes to £64 a week. She does it for nothing, you know. It's just weird. It's just strange phenomenon.
Yeah, it's very strange when you imagine what carers throughout, you know, the world are saving the health services.
That must be billions, you know. If they all went on strike for the day, you'd soon know about it.
One of those professions, as I call it, where you can't go on strike, can you, unfortunately? Kind of defeats the object, what you're trying to achieve.
It's like what they say about the nurses, you know, it's a vocation, they don't need much money. How ridiculous is a quote like that for the politicians to come up with?
Tell me a little bit about your golf. You're obviously a golfing man.
And
also tell me a little bit about this driving range you set up in the back garden with the help of a duvet.
My dad was a golfer. He was a scratch golfer and he used to caddy for him. So I picked up that, and then I used to play football before golf, and then I took up golf again and got down to playoff eight. It was in a good standard, like, you know. during lockdown, because we couldn't get to play golf, you know, it was like it was worse than the withdrawal off the lithium, you know, not being able to play golf. So we'll use one of the duvets and make it. Unfortunately, I went and used the good one rather than the old one, like, you know. So nailed it onto the back of the shed and painted a, you know, a bullseye circle into it, and then just started chipping the ball in. I'm very, very good at chipping from that. Like, you know, but the good thing about lockdown was it's a funny thing to say, but I'm glad lockdown came because it gave society a taste of what social isolation is. You know, I have to talk about, you know, people mentioned social isolation. Society didn't know what social isolation was until you're told that you can't go on. You can't go on holiday. You can't go meet your friends. You know, you've got to stay in. You can't go to the shops. You've got to do this. And that's, people actually got a taste of it, but they don't like it. Society does not like being told you cannot go and do it. But we're getting told that every day, you know. And we want to go out. We want to go out. But the way society treats us sometimes when we go out, it's, if you have a bad experience, you don't want to go out again. And then you'll sit on the couch, and that's when dementia will come and sit with you. dementia loves you to be on your own. It absolutely loves you to be on your own, because it doesn't like me talking to you, and it doesn't like me talking to your listeners, because that's taking away the fear and the stigma of what dementia is, and that people can't do these things. I mean, one of the funniest things I get is people saying, how come you can talk if you've got dementia? You know, and I think, yeah, that's a great thing. Like, I'll tell you a funny story about that. I was on a bus, and I was sitting on one of the disabled seats, and there was a young fella and a girl on the other seat, the long seat, and the girl said something to the fella, and the fella said, excuse me, mate. I said, what? He said, you can't sit there. I said, why not? He said, they're for disabled people. Well, I've got a disabled pass. So I said, hey, I'm disabled. He said, you don't look disabled. I said, you don't look stupid. You know, it's just, what does a person with dementia actually look like? You know? So it must be eight, what is it? 80 million people in the world with dementia or something like that. So we all look the same because we've got dementia. You know, it just doesn't work like that. You know?
The Brother Brothers and Waltzing's Four Dreamers here on the D Word. We're always on the lookout for new guests, so if you're working on an interesting project or have a story to tell, you can contact us on social media at Radio DDW on Twitter, the Radio DDW Facebook page, where you'll also find lots of useful information, or an email to tdwradio@gmail.com. My guest this week is Tommy Dunn, who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 58. One thing he has found is that some people find it hard to talk to anyone with dementia.
People say, I've never talked to people with dementia. So the same way you talk to anyone, you know, treat them as a normal person. I said, you sometimes may get asked to repeat something, because I said, what happens when you've got Alzheimer's is some of the signals don't go across, and it's like the old Norma Collier, when he used to tour, you know, and he used to go, hello there, are you, and bits of words wouldn't come out. So I sometimes say, I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that. So then they shout, they go, what it is then? And they go, no, not that. I just don't get it. But when you explain why you didn't get it, you get it then, like, you know, so. And then if you're not really sure of something, you can always ask them, can you just put that another way? You know, but don't give up and say, oh, I'll give up. Like, you know, I think one of the saddest things I ever heard of someone was when he said to me, I don't speak to my mum anymore because she doesn't speak to me. I thought, that's outrageous, you know. And I said, your mum may have lost the ability to communicate verbally, but you can still talk to her. You can tell her what your day is. And I said, you can still hold her hand, give her a hug and that. And it might come back then, you know. But I said, because what you're doing is punishing it for not being able to communicate. I mean, the strangest thing is, you know, in that instance, I said, well, people will talk to plants and people will talk to animals, but they won't talk to a person with dementia because they think you can't understand. So we're lower than the plant life and the animal life, you know. And it just seems strange to me that sort of thing can still happen.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy, actually. I hadn't kind of thought along those lines. And I guess it's really, you know, tell me what I can do, not what I can't do. Because, you know, I wouldn't have the ingenuity to set up a golf range in my back garden using a duvet. So, you know, it's what you can do, not what you can't do, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing people should be looking at. It's what we can do, not what we can't do. You know, it seems to treat us like old dogs that we can't learn new tricks. they've got dementia, they can't learn, or they can't take up painting, or they can't take up singing, or they can't do this. And, you know, we can do all those sorts of things. It gives a chance. It's because someone with dementia might not be able to do it, but you can't assume that everyone else with dementia can't do it. So we're all individuals, and, you know, you get that expression thousands of times, you see me in the dementia, and I'm expressing my dementia, and, you know, you know, Chris Roberts uses that expression, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, you know, there's a lot of, I'm very interested in social history. My friends living with dementia are brilliant resources of social history. And I know you've got the Museum of Liverpool, haven't you, with their House of Memories programme. We actually had Carol from the museum on the show probably about 6 months ago. And I think things like that are, you know, a terrific, terrific projects.
Yeah, but that's a great example. You know, if you can't take the person to the museum, you can bring the museum into the person. But, you know, give them something that's interesting, something that they can relate to, you know, because our long-term memories, my long-term memory is brilliant, you know, place of quizzes. But if you ask me what happened there yesterday or something like that, remember some of it, I can't remember all of it, like, you know, and I struggle to name the prime ministers now, like, you know, well, I think everyone does now, like, you know, but, you know, I used to be able to tell you all the prime ministers up until a certain moment, and it just goes blank here. It's weird.
Yeah, I follow your Twitter feed, and there's some really useful, you know, I think you've captured the market in trying to do it in 140 characters and get something really useful across. And for me, your words take on more power because you're actually going through it. It's your life.
Yeah, that was it's going to make sense. I mean, there's no use putting quantity out there. You can put a bit of quality out so people can understand it short and sweet and they can remember it. Because if you put 5,000 words down, you know, people aren't going to remember it. But they remember little bite sizes, you know, which is great.
Yeah, and I think it's great, you know, as you described at the beginning, go to a meeting and having no one living with dementia there. I've been to Dementia Action Alliances, and I said, well, isn't there someone missing? And they sort of looked at me, and I said, well, isn't someone with dementia coming? Because, you know, there is nothing like the lived experience.
I know, yeah. The only people that can actually tell you what it's like to live with dementia. Care is the only one that can tell you what it's like to care for someone with dementia. That's what people have got to understand. If you want to know something, ask the person that is living it and knows it. Like, you know. I mean, I couldn't tell you what it's like to give birth to a child. Obviously, it can't be that painful because people have loads of kids, don't they? My apologies. No. But, you know, it's asking the right people the right questions and more importantly, giving them the time to answer the question, you know. Because that's what a little story I'll tell you about not giving people time to answer the question was. I go to the Everton Pass on the Memories group after, and 7 years ago, there was a fella coming in with his wife and his daughter for the first time, and so I looked at them and said, "Hello, my name's Tommy. Who are you?" And his wife said, "His name's John." So I'm looking at him all the time now. So I said, "Hello, John." So I said, "Where did you used to work?" Because I don't think he's one of that age that you'd always work. So his daughter said, he was a cobbler. So I said, where did you used to be a cobbler? And his wife said, on the corner of the Beach Street in Kensington. I said, I used to pass that going to school. So I said, did you used to sit in the window? Yeah, my dad used to sit in the window. So I said, still looked at it. I said, what type of shoes did you used to make? So he said, I make clogs. And it took me back then. I said, clogs? Because I'm thinking the wooden clogs, you know. I said, how do you make clogs? He said, well, you've got to learn. You put them on the mast and you went through how you made a pair of clogs. And his wife said, he never speaks. And I felt like he's hated. You're not giving him a chance to. So he was sitting with us then. And then the fellow who runs it said to the wife and the daughter, do you want to go and do some shopping and just leave him here? So he went out like, and he said, thank God for that. I never get a word in with them too. And what it is, the wife and daughter, they're not comfortable with the silence. So because he was taking time just to think of the answer, they didn't want to they could look embarrassed, so they answered for him. So if you don't use it, you lose it. So he's just got to give us time to let the cogs go, come up with the answer. You know, we're going through the files looking for that. There's the answer there. Like, it's not like you get, you know, in the old days, you just get asked the question and you come up with the answer straight away. You just got to go and go through the catalogues.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Cinderella from Catherine McGrath. I'm talking to Tommy Dunn about his dementia journey, which of course included a global pandemic.
Yeah, I've seen it more since lockdown. Lockdown knocked us all a little bit, you know, not getting out to meet, because we were put into that. Lockdown, I think about 4 weeks before everyone else went into it, you know, and then we couldn't come out until another 4 weeks after everyone was out, you know. So it was just horrible seeing people going out and then you couldn't go out, and then you were locked in the house all the time. So you just got used to your own company, and that's the worst thing you can do with dementia, because you become comfortable sitting in the chair and you don't want to do things then, like, you know, at all. Then when lockdown going out for the first time, I was actually scared, you know. I thought, God, I feel nervous. I really do feel on edge, you know. And so it was like when you first diagnosed and you're going out because you think, well, everyone knows I've got dementia and stuff like that, you know. But, you know, the great thing about, you know, like your radio show is you're talking about dementia, you're talking about the D word, it's out there, you know. And that's the thing that's, you know, 10 years ago, the word wasn't hardly mentioned. People wouldn't even know what it was, you know. But so the fact that it's out there now, people are talking about it, you know. It can, that's the only thing that can take the fear and the stigma away from it.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's important. It's the reason I set the show up. But I think it's also important. I mean, we tell good news stories about some great projects which are going out. Great things that are happening that, you know, are often hidden. I mean, you know, the newspapers to me seem to be in for the kind of eat more strawberries and you won't get Alzheimer's type headline. Whereas some of the really great people that I talk to are doing stuff that's kind of under the radar.
Yeah, and that's the trouble. The papers want to go for the sensational headlines rather than the good stories that you mentioned, because good stories don't sell newspapers, really. You know, people don't want to hear that people can live, not saying live better with dementia, but you've got to have the incentive to get up and get out and do something for yourself. You know, you can't sit there and rely on other people to do everything for you. You've got to help, and you've got to do things to make your life better for your carer as well, you know. So I feel a responsibility to my wife for me to do well, so it takes the pressure off her, like, you know.
Yeah, I think it's also, you know, it's something that it's very difficult for us sometimes when we're in a position where we don't feel we're in control. So when you first get your diagnosis, you're not in a position of control, whereas with a lot of the things you're doing, I think you've gained control back.
That's why it's important that initially, when you've been diagnosed, you go to your support groups, you start to gain the confidence, and then, you know, I was with my fellow peer Paul Litchfield. We write music and we record the music and that. But I remember I met him at his first post-diagnostic group, because I went and I used to go and do talks to the post-diagnostic groups, still do, like, but, you know, and he was there, so I met him afterwards and I just said to him, want to go for a pint? And he went, oh, yeah. So we started that, and I said, how do you feel? And he said, I just feel like jumping off the ferry, he said, because said, your wife's older. There's not to do. And I said, why don't you come with me? I've got a few talks booked. Come and sit with me, you know, sit on stage by me. And so we did that. And then one day I said, we'd like to hear Paul's story. You know, so he told his story. Then again, and then every time we went, he did that. So got him to do that. And then I got him to do a post-diagnostic group on his own while I sat down. And it was great. Because I always say to the people when I'm doing the post-diagnostic group, next year, I said, I want news to be standing up in front of the next post-diagnostic group, telling them how well you've done this year and how you've got to build their confidence up. Because, as you know, you're in the worst place you can be in your life now. You know, you're at the lowest. Everybody's up now, so it's up to you. You've got to pick yourself up and get up there and get out there. And when you do, you'll find you've got a lot of living to do, because you don't go from getting diagnosed into the latter stages of dementia. You know, I was most probably lucky that I was misdiagnosed, because you found that curriculum. My wife could have not pushed for the second diagnosis, so I'd just been like a zombie getting treated for the bipolar.
Time's drawing it's a little bit to a close. As a big football fan, I've got to talk a little bit about, you're an Everton fan, I know, and a lot of the work they do in the community, including groups that you attend.
Do fantastic work in the community. They do it for the war veterans, the children, the overseas. They've got that many groups, the homeless. You know, but it's a group where you get some Liverpool supporters come for the first time and they think it's all going to be about football and talking about Everton, but it's not. It's about enjoying yourself, enjoying it. You know, football's really talked about, especially nowadays. Like, but, you know, but there's one football story comes to my mind, and my son always reminds me of it. It was when we played Bayern Munich in the semi-final of the Cup in this Cup at Goodison Park. And in them days, we didn't have much money, you know, because they won't have much money in them days. The £4.20, so it was £2 to get in the ground. And we went, and they put the price up. We bought to the ground. They put the price up another 20 pence. So 20 pence short now, you know, oh my God. So I then see a fella, no, my son knows I'd never ask anyone for money ever in my life. So I said, you couldn't do us a favour, so I said, lend us 20 pence. So he lent us and got in. My son always says, that was the greatest day of my life, he said, because the match was great. And he said, you did something there that was so special, he said, because I knew how hard it was for you to go and ask someone for money. And, you know, it always brings a tear to me. I want to think about that.
Thank you. Again, another great story. Well, Tommy, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm sure if I'm ever Liverpool away, we could have a pint together and talk football, which would be really good. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And as I say to people, keep on doing what you're doing.
No problem. Anytime. Thank you very much, Pete. Enjoyed it very, very much.
My thanks to Tommy for a great chat. I can highly recommend his Twitter feed, which is at TommyTommyT18. Well, that's it for another week. Thanks as always to my production assistant, Angela. Next week, we're going to be talking dementia coaching with my guest, Ethel Lord. So until then, thanks for listening and take care now.